weighted down by possessions, weighted down by the gun, weighted down by the river. For you to come, my darling, you darn in my action of when 3 months I was gone. But whose socks were you darning, darling, while I've been gone so long? Weighted down by possession, weighted down by the gun, weighted down by the river. For you to come, best friend to your ear, Drew said I was guilty of sin, said my being gone was the best thing for you. But the truth, it all comes through for me and my kin. It wasn't the best thing for me, but it was the best for you.
This is a WGXC 90.7 Accra Radio for Open Ears. We are here for the newest installment of Reading is Funkdemental. That is a show all about books about music, sometimes written by the musicians themselves, sometimes by biographers. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician with bands Spaghetti Eastern Music and Space Heater and a bunch of others, Guitars of Go-Go. And I also write about music for the New York Times, Pop Matters, Inside Out, Upstate New York, and Pop Matters, where I had this review of the book we're going to talk about today. That is a book by Cam Cobb. It is a fantastic biography of Skip Spence, the famous sort of star-crossed frontman of the legendary Moby Grape, who created one of the great solo albums, Or, an intriguing piece of audio. Let's just say audio. We also have the pleasure of having with us today Don Stevenson, who was the drummer and a chief songwriter in Moby Grape. He wrote some of the best songs, including Hey Grandma, 805, and my personal favorite, Murder in My Heart for the Judge. We had a great, long, winding conversation. We opened up with some music from my band, Guitar as a Go-Go, with Rick Warren. That's a couple of ambient cats. A little chunk of something called Volcano Lovers, which goes on 20 minutes. And then Weighted Down by Skip Spence from Or, which is actually the title of Cam's book. So without further ado, let's get to the interview.
Okay, we are here with Cam Cobb, who is the author of a great book called Weighted Down, The Complicated Life of Skip Spence, and one of the original Moby Grape gentlemen, a great song, one of the great songwriting drummers, songwriting, singing, and beat playing drummers, Don Stevenson. So we're going to really just get in and talk about not only this great book and Skip and the great, but also to catch up with Don on some of his recent things. And I should also tell you, we're going to talk about real estate. I saw something about that you had been gone into the real estate business after sort of concurrent to music. Is that true?
I was in the private members club up in Whistler, British Columbia.
Yeah.
And was selling a private members club, which was a very upscale timeshare.
Right.
So we partnered with Disney and had villas in Tuscany. It was really
interestingly enough, I had done a story about 2 months ago for Rolling Stone, all about rock stars who sidelined it into real estate. But we'll talk about that later. It started when I talked to Carmen Appice from the Vanilla Fudge, a piece from the Vanilla Fudge. Yeah. Long story, but let's start with the book. Cam, why a book about Skip? How did you get interested in it? How long did it take you to do? And I know you interviewed a real load of folks for this book.
So years ago, I did a book on Moby Grape. And at one point, I was helping Don organize a show in Toronto that was going to be at a dinner theater venue. And we organized for Skip's son, Omar, to come to Toronto for the show.
Right.
And Omar came and stayed at my place for a couple of nights. And at one point, Omar and I were talking. And at one point, Omar said that he really, wished that there was a book about his dad. And I thought, this is a very good idea. And so it kind of gave me a chance to revisit things that I did with the Moby Grape book. I could write about the story in a slightly different way, focusing on Skip's experiences. And I started in the summer of 2019, and I thought it was going to be done maybe around 2021 or something like that. And with COVID, it kind of slowed down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I also encountered some tricky parts where I wrote fairly quickly. I had about 90,000 words by March of 2020. Mm. I knew I'd have to trim some of these words, but I was already up to about the Skip's age when he was like 25, 26.
Right.
And then it stressed me out. I was thinking, like, I've written 90,000 words about this. How can I possibly write 90,000 words about the second half of his life?
Right.
Or what am I going to do? 1,000 words about the second half of his life? That's going to be so lopsided. I don't like that in a biography. Right. When the last 20 years is like covered one page. So I had a real tough time for a little while trying to figure that out. And I did feel guilty. Like, I had a lot of people like in the family and people in Moby Grape and around Moby Grape who had really, I felt like they put their trust in me and they were chin with me. So I felt a little guilty for a while. And there were some people I didn't call for a while because I felt so guilty. But then I got rolling again in September of, I think it was 2021, I really got my momentum back. And I'm also a professor, so I sometimes get sidetracked with this grading that has to be
grading
done.
Papers, yes, of course.
I had to do some grading in January of 2022, I think it was. And then, so I had to put the book aside for a while, but it wasn't because I was having difficulty writing. It was just that I had to put aside to get some other stuff done. And so then it took just finalizing it took a couple of years, and there were new people who it was also in some ways a happy accident because there were new people who I got in touch with as the book got in the home stretch. What I did try to do with the book was actually communicate with people in the order in which Skip met them in his life. So I was actually following his footsteps in that way. And so like people like Sherry, his sister, she was the person I was talking to, a lot. And after Sherry, it was people like Robbie and Jeff Levin, who played with Skip in the folk scene in
San Jose.
And then it was people, in Moby Grape. And then I was like going to them again and like Columbo asking them, "It's just one more thing I've got to ask you." And so I would do that. And then it was getting to Skip's time, between his when he left Moby Grape and his time in Moby Grape's reunion of 20 Granite Creek. So Gordon Stevens, who Don was just mentioning, Gordon was a member of the band in 1971, and Gordon really filled in a lot of gaps for that period of Skip's life. And I talked to some of Skip's friends during those times when Skip was living on the streets or almost living on the street. And you know, the thing that really struck me throughout is that people had tremendous love, and I would use the present tense, have tremendous love for Skip, and have such fond memories of this person who was so high energy, so creative, had so much possibility. And that always struck me from whatever decade in his life, people were, you know, had smiles and fond memories of Skip to share.
Well, you really do start. You give a lot of context to sort of where Skip came from in terms of dealing a lot with his childhood. His father was, also a musician to some degree. And so, if you could give us a little bit about, Skip's childhood, how he sort of got into music. I know his mother got him a guitar at 10, who his early inspirations are. And then I just want to shift to you, Don, and hear a little bit about, how you got into music and what your early inspirations were. But first to you, Kemp.
Sure. Okay. So Skip wrote a song called Just Like Gene Autry, a Foxtrot, that's on Moby Grape's second album, Wow slash Grape Jam. And that song, you know, in a lot of ways sort of calls back to his dad's experiences. His dad was really talented on the piano and as a crooner. And his dad had these gigs. His dad was a distinguished soldier in World War II. He was a bomber pilot, and he got this thing called the Distinguished Flying Cross that very few soldiers got. And his dad pursued different things after the war, and he had these gigs. And so Skip was born in Windsor, Ontario, which is it's very odd that there's a Canadian city immediately south of an American city. I always find that so disorienting. America's to the north. And so Jock had these the running gigs there, and he played at this place called the Commodore Club, and he had a long one there in the 40s. And then he had these gigs in America, like down in Ohio, and then eventually they moved down to Phoenix. But I think Skip was really influenced by that experience with his dad. And Gordon has told me several times that Skip really wanted to be like a, you know, a union, card-carrying union member, musician. And so I think that influenced him, this idea of being a professional musician. And I think he had a real fondness for that old style of music. And of course, Skip was also very sly and mischievous. So he did that song that's all it's an homage to that old style, and he's also having fun with it. So I think that was a big influence with Skip. He loved rock and roll too. When he had that period between when he was in Bellevue Hospital and he got out of Bellevue Hospital and he recorded his album, or after that, he dabbled with the Doobie guys who later formed the Doobie Brothers. And he, if it were Skip, these guys wouldn't have met each other. And then also he reconnected with his pal from high school, Bill Anders, who had his own band called Weird Harold, which was a talented band. And Skip and Bill formed this band called Pachuco, and they were like rock and roll music. And so Skip loved rock and roll. He loved the Stones. He's one of the people who like moved from folk to rock very effortlessly, because he was a real folkie in the early 60s, but he loved rock and roll as well. So trading in his acoustic guitar to play electric was something that was he was fun. He embraced it when after Dylan influenced so many people to
Yeah,
do
well, it's
that.
kind of interesting you said that, and you said that, obviously Dylan at Newport and that era. And then also you said LSD coming into inspiring folkies to go electric. But let's go to you, Don, because speaking of rock and roll, you come out of the Seattle scene. And if you could give us a little bit about your background, your early interest in music, what got you into it? And then I know you had the band the Frantics, and then came down.
It was almost comical. I got into music just as a lark. A friend of mine, Ed Kleffner, he had him and Pat Fahey had a little band where they were putting a band together. And I was in junior, sophomore in high school. And Ed asked me, he said, we're looking for a drummer. You know, we need to get a drummer. And I really love sports. I played all kinds of sports, but I was never great and was too small and too slow. And I figured, you know, when he asked, he said, do you know anybody who plays drums? We need a drummer. And I said, I do. And I'd never played drums or anything before, you know, musically. So, but I felt that this was like a good move even for a high school guy, you know, is to be able to be a drummer for many reasons. And so we got together and we practiced. We had they did a couple of Duane Eddy, you know, songs like that kind of stuff and little three chord things. And we had two or three practices, and it almost like struck out at the very beginning because my nature being a just a white kid in Seattle, I was thought that the beat should probably be on one and three. Almost doomed me from the beginning, but I finally got it turned around and played with the Continentals, and that's what that band turned out to be. And ultimately, it turned out to be a pretty funky band. By the time I was a senior in high school, we were playing down at the Black and Tan and at Birdland. We were like not a house band, but we would go play at Birdland, which was an all-black club down in the Essler area in Seattle. And we were rhythm and blues with horns and guitars and, you know, and not too many vocals, mostly instrumental in those days. So we played a lot of music, and that ended up being my passion. Instead of being a lark, it became I ate, drank, slept, thought, breathed my drums, you know. And
Well, when did songwriting enter the fray for you? When do
it's
you?
not till later. I became really, I wanted to be a jazz player. You know, I played with B3 Hammond organs, and we backed up Etta Jones and Etta James and Big Mama Thornton, and played with Jimmy McGriff and Jack McDuff and these after hours clubs. Those were the days where you had 6 night-a-week gigs, and you'd have a gig for 6 nights a week, and that gig would last you for, you know, for months. And people would show up all the time. And I'd pack up my stuff and go down to the Black and Tan and play with the B3 Hammond organ trio. So I had no idea of singing or playing or writing songs, but when I met Jerry, that's when it opened up. It kind of changed everything. I was smoking a big fatty one day with John Keelior, who was the drummer with the Frantics, and he put a headset on me just like you have, only it was played the Birds, and I'd never heard the Birds before. And I'm telling you, I really wanted to be a jazz player. That's what I loved. I loved just being in the midst of this improvisation and freedom. And I heard the Birds, and I went, wait a minute, time out. And then I ended up being actually the guy who turned me on, John Keelior, was the drummer of the Frantics, and he ended up getting in a terrible car accident. And I was playing in the Playboys, and Chuck Shoney was Chuck Stakes, eventually down in San Francisco. He played with Quicksilver, but he called me and asked me if I'd like to come and play drums with the Frantics. They had a gig in Tacoma, Top Hat, 6 nights a week, and they were already set up to go down to California to make it big. You know, that's what they wanted to do. That's when I met Jerry.
Oh, cool. So let's talk about to go back to Skip. So he kind of comes of age in that San Jose folk scene, which was populated by people like Yorma, Janis Joplin did her time through there, Jerry Garcia. Then Marty Balin, I'm not sure how you say it. He sees him, he thinks he looks cool, and says, "Hey, do you want to join my band and play drums?" Something he never did before. So how does he get from sort of the airplane? And what was his time like in the airplane? And then I understand from your book, Quicksilver was really the inspiration for him to pick up a guitar again and join you guys and do the great.
So, is this for me, this question?
Oh yes, I'm sorry,
Yeah,
Cam. Yeah.
okay. So, Skip was rehearsing with what was kind of like a proto Quicksilver band in September of 65. His dad had passed away in May. And during the summer, he played in Tahoe. He formed this band called The Mains, and it was
Right,
kind of
Rocky.
a temporary band. And so he played with them. And he also performed with Bill Anders. There's like a little news image of him and little passage on him with Bill Anders performing folk on stage with acoustic guitars. So he's rehearsing with this band that later becomes Quicksilver in the Matrix, which is this, used to be a pizza parlor south of the Wharf District in San Francisco. Balin is one of the owners of the club. And Balin is, you know, has this band, Jefferson Airplane, at the time. And he looks at Skip and he sees there's something with this guy. This guy's got real charisma. And so he wants him in the band, only he's flush with guitarists. Right. So he asks Skip, you know, can you play drums? And I think Skip was a little hesitant, but he agreed to do it. And a few weeks later, he ends up down in LA with the Airplane as a member of the Airplane as their drummer. He's played some gigs with them by that point, and they're auditioning for Phil Spector. And the audition didn't go to a contract, but a couple months after that, they have signed with RCA, and they're back down recording in December, just like days after the Stones were in the studio, the Airplane's in the studio, starting work on what will become their first album, Jefferson Airplane Takes Off. And on December 10th, I think I got the date written down here, on December 10th, 65, Skip is performing with the Airplane in the Fillmore at the first time that we have a rock show happening at the Fillmore. Mm-hmm. And Bill Graham, who is this mercurial, larger than life promoter, like he's like a rock star himself. And he has organized this event because he's working what he'd been doing, like he'd been earning a lot of money. I can't remember if it was in advertising. He'd been making good money. And then he quit that to pursue managing this theater group called the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which was doing like advocacy work and performance art. And so they were getting in trouble sometimes. They were performing these plays that, you know, you weren't supposed to be performing. They're testing the laws, you know, and pushing for free speech. And so they got into trouble now and then. And Bill Graham started organizing these benefits for them. And he did one in November at a warehouse, and then he did one in December 10th, 1965, at the Fillmore. And so Skip was there at the first rock show at the Fillmore. So this is like ground zero of rock shows here at the Fillmore and the ballrooms. And it really changes, that's changing music. Like when we get this different kinds of performance spaces where the sound quality is better and people are trying to create these experiences where you've got these visuals happening, people have taken these substances. So they're like having a very different experience at the show. And tremendous sound quality, these long shows, you can see the performers in these venues. So it's not like they're performing in a bowling alley anymore. It's like this great kind of like, almost like churches in a way, the kind of experience mm-hmm. that people are having. And so Skip has that with the Jefferson Airplane. And they record the album throughout the winter, going up and down from LA to San Fran. Skip's living up in Corte Madera with his family at the time. And it ends up that when late spring rolls around, Skip goes on a little hiatus, apparently down to Mexico, unannounced. And Skip was always very, very free.
Impulsive.
Very free. Yeah, impulsive and free. Yeah. And so he went down, and for a lot of, you know, for large portions of his life, he's like a cat who landed on his legs all the time. And right. So up until then, like everything always, he lands on his legs. So he's booted out of Jefferson Airplane. It is, although it's very friendly because Skip writes for their next album and mm-hmm. he guests on their next album. Right. And so he's kind of booted out of the band around May, June of 1966. They've got the whole album recorded. The first album's going to come out in August. So now he's without a band. And in the summertime, he gets together with the manager, who is soon going to be the ex-manager of the Airplane, Matthew Cates, and Skip and Matthew audition different people for a new band. And as luck would have it, we end up with what's like, you know, kind of a super group of talent. We've got these five people who have all these different experiences, and they're all so proficient at what they do. And so Moby Grape eventually emerges out of these rehearsals in the summertime. And it's like really late summer that Moby Grape, the final lineup, the mm-hmm. proper line, you know, like the classic lineup of Moby Grape forms. And so that's how we get to like basically September of 1966.
So was that when they were, I'm sorry, forgive me if I'm getting Corte Madera and
Corte Madera. Yeah, that's where Skip was living. So they would come up there and
you guys, I just actually sold a house barge. I had a house barge for 20 years, a houseboat. And you guys did a lot of your, I'm going to turn it over to Don now. You did a lot of your kind of woodshedding and getting the act together on a houseboat in Sausalito, correct? A club?
Yeah, it was actually on an old ferry boat.
Oh, okay.
The Ark. But there was no, but we went back down to the houseboats and played, and we had some friends that lived there. There was houseboats right next to the Ark itself. But yeah, we were in rehearsals at the Ark when the band finally formed. That's kind of where it became a little bit of a showcase. We were there with Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company and, you know, Lee Michaels and, you know, with Buffalo Springfield and us. And we're all there practicing and playing, and nobody even knew we were there. Nobody had heard of any of us. And we just worked out all of our stuff there for months. And then they opened the place up to after hours, and people would come over from the Fillmore and the Avalon after the Fillmore and the Avalon closed, and they had come over to experience these three bands, four bands actually, with some sets that went on early into the morning till the sun rose. Then we'd have some breakfast and go home and go to bed.
So then this band comes together, and there's this frantic bidding war for your services. And so tell us a little bit about that whole thing and how the first album came together. And then obviously I used to be a publicist myself. So, you know, there was sort of a misstep in the promotion, let's say, for the first album, releasing five singles at one time, a party, a bust after the party. So let's hear a little bit from you about that whole.
Well, say what the road to hell leads with good intentions, right?
Yes, so it sure did.
I think this road led to hell for some great intentions. Nobody tried to subvert everything. It just managed to like subvert itself on the back of good ideas, or at least they thought they were at the time. But yeah, the place was just buzzing with all kinds of A&R people because the airplane had taken off, and and it was obvious that this was the center of the musical revolution that was in San Francisco and in this area, because it was just an epicenter for all kinds of creative music going on. And so obviously a lot of the record companies were there to try to find out who the next real thing was going to be, and be able to plug into it and be able to promote it and to have, you know, have that music listened to by the people that would enjoy it, and the promotion would help the record company. Right. And so it's just business. That's the business. So we had Ahmed Aragon and Elektra and RCA and Columbia and all these people that were vying for our attention. And to make a long story short, we went with David Rubinson with Columbia, and he was like, we really like David, you know. It was a couple of things. Jerry said we should never have signed with Matthew, which I always think, God, man, Jerry, I wish I'd have listened to you.
Yeah.
So Matthew went together and put together the deal with Columbia behind whatever. They took us back in a back room and chopped us up and divided us into little pieces so that the only little pieces were left for us.
Yeah.
And so, but that's what happened. But the joy of making the music and the joy of being able to move into studios and do that.
And what was really unique about you guys is like a lot, I don't know who said it, whether it's Don Kirshner or whatever, but in terms of having songs for a San Francisco band, you guys had great writers, great songs, tight material, although you guys could also jam. And actually, I have to say, two of my favorite songs on that album or two that you wrote are Hey Grandma and 805 is beautiful song, beautiful ballad. So in my opinion, those are my two favorite songs on the album. So then you take off, you're off on the, well, there was a little bit of something after the party, after your launch party at the Avalon. Some people,
I don't know how I missed out on that misbehavior.
I know you're
full of misbehavior at the time, but I did. So they, So I think it was Peter and Jerry and Bob all ended up with
Not
some
Bob,
un
Skip.
or Skip.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Skip ended up with some underage girls up in some part of the Great Redwood Forest.
Who
And
happened to, whose dad happened to be like the police chief or something? What was that,
that's
Cam?
right.
Yeah.
That's
So,
right.
yeah.
And so all hell broke loose and bad publicity came out. And but in a way, bad publicity for rock and roll at that time was probably good publicity if you
Yeah.
look at it that way. But it did put a little bit of a a downer on our big release party. That along
Yeah.
with the fact that they released a billion orchid blossoms or whatever
Right.
and
30,000.
on the floor, and everybody was trying to dance and slipping and sliding at the Fillmore on our
Does
release party.
anybody still have a bottle of Moby Grape wine from that event?
I think there is a few people, but I don't
That
know who
must
they
be.
are.
That must be, but that should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But so
That's
then
right.
you're off, you're off and running across the country touring. Was this when you guys did the was this the era when you did the Mike Douglas show and all that stuff?
No,
Was
that
that
was
after the
before. That was before. They did Mike Douglas in January of 68. So in the summer of 67, that's when they started doing their touring. And they were kicked off a tour with Mamas and Papas when there was a kind of a scuffle with the Buckinghams. And that was summer of 67. And the show with Mike Douglas was early January of 68, actually right before they had the trial for the event that happened after the record release
And
for Rubber Band.
you realize the producer of the Mike Douglas show at that time was a gentleman named Roger Ailes, who went on to create Fox News. So we have that. We have that to go. So then you go into the second album. You had a great song on the second album, which I love to listen to when I went to divorce court. It was called Murder in My Heart for the Judge. Was that a, did that come out of the bus situation or the
You know,
arrest, or is it
I don't
just
want to skip over
go
this
ahead?
faux pas that Columbia did for our release because of your former profession. I always have an imagination. This is like I've said, I told you this a couple of times, but I always really imagine right when Columbia got a hold of us and they said, these guys are really great. You know, this is going to be the new Beatles. They all write, they all sing, they have three guitars. There's nothing like this. We got the bull by the horns. This is awesome. You know what we're going to do? I got an idea. Let me tell you about this. Not one, not two, not three, not four, five. There's five hit songs on that. There's 10 hit songs on this album. You know, we're going to put all these, let's do this. We'll release five singles at the same time. It's going to saturate the market. People are going to love this. It's going to be the amazing thing. You could not believe how great this is going to be. I got the idea. Everybody's going, I like it. I like it. It's a good idea. We should do this. So they released all five of those albums and nobody knew what to play. People thought we were the Monkees. You know, there was a big hype job and
Well,
none of them,
even
none of them.
yeah, like even the Beatles and the Stones would like, coordinate on their releases. They never released, it was like the Beatles had one. They said, we'll take April, you guys take May. And they even, supposed competitors would do that. So then you go on to the second album, and let's skip ahead to the some of the famous incidents, the famous incident in New York where Skip decides he's a fireman. Or how did that all come about? This was during when you were in the Fillmore, playing at the Fillmore, correct? The
Yes, this
famous
is,
incident.
and this is June of 68,
Yes,
which
we're
is
jumping
after the
ahead.
second album. So this is like after, this is when they're actually starting to map out their third, what they thought would be their third album at the time. And yeah.
Well, I do think that prior to that, I mean, I've had a lot of great experiences with Skip before that. I mean, early days meeting him and being with him and laughing and, playing and creating together. We sat in the stairwell in Columbia Studios in New York. The three of us, Jerry, myself, and Skip, had written Someday. And we sat there and for probably an hour at least or 2 hours, where we just sat there and went over the lyrics until we could perform this song as one voice. If you listen to Someday, it sounds like there's only one person singing until the bridge where Bob Mosley comes in and breaks the sound barrier. But the effort and the togetherness, the spirit that we had to be united and be able to breathe at exactly the same time and sing the exact same words was a great connection with Skip. And so I had a lot of wonderful times with Skip. And in New York at that time, fast forward a couple of years, and he had been, we all had done our fair share of drugs, and
Got it.
we did some LSD, and we did tripped out together. I had some great experiences with acid, for LSD, and Skip. I think Skip got into some harder drugs. He got into some pretty hard drugs along with psychedelics, and he met this very unusual, strange warlock, or which actually was a witch, a professed acting witch in Greenwich Village, and was living with her. I went down to visit him because he had missed rehearsals and had not been showing up in New York when we're supposed to be playing at the Fillmore, kind of the close of the Fillmore. And I was worried about him, and went down and to see him. And he was there in this little basement apartment in Greenwich Village. He had this old guy laying on the couch, kind of like looked like I do now. So it's this,
Joel.
yeah. Well, this older guy, I think he was a street person at the time. And he was their oracle, and they would ask him questions, and he would give them yes or no answers and tell them, which direction to head. And Skip talked to me when I went down to see him about joining a new band, and he wanted me to be in the new band, and it was called the Cows, and we should leave the Moby Grape behind, and it's time for a new thing and all this stuff. And this woman that he was with was very strange and very threatening, and he was one time he was like laughing and rolling his eyes back up in his head and having this laugh that he had when he knew something was funny that nobody else quite understood, and the next thing it was pretty threatening, and so the whole experience was perplexing. And that's when we went back to the Albert Hotel, and a few days later, that's where I found out that Jerry and I were bunking together. Jerry, for the moment I met Jerry, he was my best friend. So brother Jerry and I were like bunking at the Albert Hotel, and we were going back up to the studio. I think we were going to go re record Big, a song we wrote down when we were in Texas. And so we went back up to the studio to record it. And when we got there, David Rubinson said that Skip was there looking for us, and that he had ill intent in his heart, and so while we went up to the studio, Skip went back down to the Albert Hotel, and that's where he had taken an axe and come through the door where we were staying. It's kind of like the "Here's Johnny," it's one of those moments. But he was like, he wasn't in his right mind. He was like, he was possessed. He was being manipulated.
What was his I mean, I have family members. I have experience with bipolar state. Was he bipolar, or what was his, was there ever a diagnosis for him? Because it sounds like
I
he
think
had manic phases and depressed phases.
I think it was schizophrenic at the time,
Oh,
and
that's,
we don't know what he would have been diagnosed with now. So Skip spent time in Bellevue. He was there for 5 months, and that was from June until November of 1968. Yorma visited him from a Jefferson Airplane when they were going through town, and Yorma told me that it was the Skippy that he knew from old days. Like it was just the Skip was just the same. I have a letter. It's actually in the book. There's a photo of a part of the letter that Skip's sister showed me that has what Skip wrote to his sister in August of 1968. He didn't get out until November. By that point, he had written a whole slew of songs while he was in there. These great songs that some of them are dark. Some of them, though, are very wacky and fun. And so they show these different sides of Skip. And some of them were kind of country, some of them were folky, some of them were a little bit more towards psychedelics. So you got this whole range that Skip was capable of. And he returned to, well, David Rubinson picked him up from Bellevue. They went to a hotel and they talked about, well, what's next? By this point, Moby Grape have been recording the third album, what ended up becoming the third album. They tried to start the third album in April of 68 and record it on and off. April, May, June, they were doing some recording on and off. And so they had a few songs like Peter had demoed If You Can Learn From My Mistakes. Don and Jerry had written Big, or what became Big. They initially called it Texas. Mm-hmm. Bob had Soul Stew. So we had these songs, and Seeing, this classic, right. This epic Skip wrote, yeah, that didn't end up on the second album, was ready to go for the third album. Bob contributed some vocals for that. So the band had this idea for a third album that they were working on, sort of the early idea for the third album. And that got fully put on the shelf, of course, when Skip had this breakdown and went to Bellevue. And they didn't know, you know, what's going to happen with Skip. And so they ended up going back into the studio in November. Skip was just about to get out of Bellevue. And at that time, the band's former manager, who they fired in September of 67, Matthew Cates, he sued them for $1 million.
Right.
So you get the band, and he's arguing that the band is broken up. He's claiming they've broken up, and so I have the right to own this name. And so the band recorded their third album in November. And then Skip gets out of Bellevue, drives his new motorbike to Boulder Creek, where his wife is with his three kids. Their daughter hasn't been born yet. And so it's Aaron and Adam and Omar. He's reunited with his family for the first time in a long time. And remember, even before his breakdown, he hadn't seen them that much because Moby Grape had been touring all over the place and they'd been recording in New York. So he'd seen very little of his family. So reuniting with his family, Skip's also figuring out and reconnecting with his kids and his wife. Mm-hmm. And they get a U-Haul and they drive with their cat, which Skip has called I Ching. Mm-hmm. And they drive with the cat all the way to Nashville. And that's where Skip records what becomes Or. And this is before Paul McCartney has done his album. And this is before Syd Barrett's albums have come out, his solo albums. Right. But Syd Barrett's albums, he had like supporting players like Dave Gilmour.
Right, yeah, they slapped it together, yeah.
Studio. Skip recorded everything on his own, and he layered everything. And so a very complicated thing to do, you know. And so Skip has these songs. He's got absolutely brilliant songs, insightful lyrics. And he puts this together over a few days in December. Right. And then the family drives to New York. And Skip's now, remember, Skip and Peter were the band members, I think Bob said the babies of the band, who ended up going to New York to mix the first album. Mm-hmm. And so Skip now is going to New York to get involved with like finalizing Or, and he's there with his wife and his kids. And in a sort of typical Skip thing, he didn't really think about, hey, wait a minute, that U-Haul was rented. They might come looking for it at some point. So he got into trouble actually with that. And so they ended up going back to, Skip was in trouble, did get in trouble, and his family moved back. They all went back to Boulder Creek, and Or ended up coming out in May of 1969. Right. And about a week after that, three remaining members of Moby Grape, Don, Jerry, and Peter, flew to Nashville with Tim Dallara, their tour manager, or their road manager, to cut their last album. They had 3 days with Bob Johnston in the studio, and they recorded what became Truly Fine Citizen.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things here is that this is a part of the book where you actually do slay some of the legend around this, that, you know, he got out of the hospital, he had his pajamas, he drove down, he did the album in like 48 hours. So no, this is not how it happened. And what I love about this book too, is you have a really good sessionography in there. So you really get a clear idea of what was recorded, and it was a lot. And also the gigography. So you see how slavishly hard these guys worked. But I wanted to go to Don for a second. You did, in the book, you mentioned, I believe you mentioned that Seeing would be a perfect song for Or. I was wondering, was there any discussion of collaborating on these songs at this time, or was it just kind of a fracture within the band where you guys were continuing doing Truly Fine Citizen and he was off?
Well, we were always hoping that Skip would return.
Right.
But he didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was like, you know, that was always our desire, is that he would come back to us and play. I saw him in Boulder Creek. up in, up in the Santa Cruz Mountains after he came back a couple of times. But he never came back and played with the band again. He went on to other things, and so did we.
Yeah, so there were selective attempts at reunions, as you chronicle in the book. And then there's the period where you did, you did cover it in a bit of detail, is the sort of the life after Orr for Skip, which, had its a lot of downs and some ups near the end, I would say, when he found Terry and Terry took care of him. But he did have periods of homelessness and and addiction and fits and starts at getting his music career back going again. But I wanted to continue with you, Don. So Skip is out of the picture. You guys go on, you do Truly Fine Citizen. What continued, what was your career like post this and your life too? Because we briefly referenced that you, and I'm always happy when a musician actually has his, responsible material life together, if you will, that, find something to kind of supplement. I was actually just talking to Todd Rundgren for a story. He's coming up here. I live in Woodstock. And I said to Todd, I said, well, what's your advice for a musician, a musician starting out today? And he's like, you need a job. You need a day job. You need a supplemental income, be it Patreon or, so if you could tell us a little bit about your continuing music career. You did two great solo albums, which I have just discovered last couple of days, King of the Fools in 2010 and the first edition of Limited Engagement, which came out last year. Yes, last year.
And there was also another album that was produced by Dane Clark from the Mellencamp band. It has a bunch of guys from John Mellencamp's band.
Oh, wow.
And has Burton Cummings singing some songs with me on it. Called Busking in the Subway.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, cool.
You dig it because it's Dane, and I had some just wonderful players. And Jerry played on it. I mean, it's got wonderful players on it.
Great.
But Skip did come and play with us a few other times. I shouldn't have said that. There were times when he showed up on stage, and times when we would try to get back together and reunite.
Right.
But it was just a mirror shadow of his former self, as far as like being in Moby Grape, right?
Right.
So what I did is I continued to play for a little while, but then I moved back up to Seattle, which was my home, and I fell in love with a lady, and I found my self as a believer, and moved into 3 days a week in church, and had a band called Holy Smoke, played at prisons and on the street, and for events that were, that were sponsored by different fellowships, played in different churches. We had also had another band called New Wine. Mm-hmm. So I continued to play, but then I moved into, it's kind of funny, I'm such a, I'm not a loser, but I am so unskilled and uneducated that if I was a baseball player, I'd be a catcher. It's just like Skip became a drummer, and I became a drummer with no idea of what I was doing. I fell into being a salesman, and then all of a sudden, over the next 25, 30 years, I realized that it was a gift and that it was a craft, and that I have a natural inclination towards caring about people and about being interested in them and finding out what was important to them. And if I could find things that I really believed in, I know I could help somebody, become compelling enough to help somebody, not scare them after death and get them to purchase articles from the smallest to the most expensive, and do it right as we speak. So that particular skill served me well, and it served me well for all my life. But I've always been, playing music and interested in music. And then probably 10 years ago, when I finally kind of, I still worked, I worked up until this year, and I'm going to be 83 in a week.
That's so good.
I worked at getting my car, driving around Ontario and selling walk-in tubs to old people,
Wow.
So that was, but I've also when I came to Toronto 10 years ago, our grandkids were out here. That's when I met Tim Bobacani, who is Burton Cummings' guitar player, and where I committed at that point, committed 100% to music, along with then my sales were just to be able to enable me to afford to be able to play music and to record music and to do that. So it's been the last decade of my life for sure. It's just been full on, you know, it's just rediscovering and being filled with all kinds of new ideas and new creative ways and learning how to play guitar well enough to, you know, to be able to create music and
well, you don't have to carry around all that stuff in the van, in the truck, driving the. No, but I want to talk about your music, your recent music, which I just again discovered. Like I said, King of Fools, a beautiful jazzy ballad. This is from the 2010 album. The new album, you know, obviously there is a spiritual theme in Thank You, Lord, which is the kickoff tune. And then Chicken Steak is totally a Moby Grape tune to me. The groove
Isn't that
is
funny?
Like, it's like,
yeah, I know I got a little blues player here called Sam Taylor, who's like the blues man of Toronto.
Yeah.
And yeah, just that Chicken Steak is just a nice little thing. And Dane Clark, the drummer from Mellencamp, is playing drums on that.
That's a great, it's great stuff.
Moves right along. Yeah. It's just a funky song. It makes me happy to hear it.
Well, you know, I have to say, I mean, this is really a, you know, I this, what this show is about is I write about, you know, I review books written by music. I'm a musician. I love books about music and, you know, often they're memoirs and then sometimes they're really authoritative stuff done by a third party. And I think you've done a fantastic job with this book, which really does put Skip into, you know, just casts a nice light on his career and his struggle. And then obviously what Moby Grape has meant to a lot of folks, older fans, and then obviously a whole new generations who continue to discover you guys. Anything else you guys want to add before we wrap it up here? Any new music, any new books in the works?
Don's got a new album.
Yeah, I've got Limited Engagement Volume 2 will be out next month.
Oh, great, great. So if you could, we will talk after that. If you could send me some of that, we'll use that in the setup and the outro to this this show. But again, thank you guys. Thank you, Cam, for writing this book and making time. And Don, great to meet you.
I do want to say I agree with you that this book is a page turner, and it's also a fitting memorial to Skip, who is an incredibly gifted dude who we were cheated not to have found out what else he would have done if he didn't pass at such a young age.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you guys for joining us. And until next time, this is Reading is Funkdimental. And till next time.